I'm Wolf Blitzer here in the Situation Room. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world that we've been listening to President Biden promoting his economic agenda. He's been speaking in Pennsylvania as he works to finally close the deal with fellow Democrats.
Look, we haven't passed a major infrastructure bill for decades in this country. Last 4 years, you'd hear every month is, you know, infrastructure month. Didn't do a single damn thing. Nothing. I mean nothing for 4 years. We can't afford to sit while other countries pass us by. We're going to breathe new life into the economy and our workforce. And here's the deal. These jobs will create that we're going to create for people who are too often left out and left behind. The vast majority of the jobs in my infrastructure bill don't require a four-year degree. 98% don't require a four-year degree. Guess what, though? It's the ultimate blue-collar, middle-class renewal. Real, serious work. It needs to get done. Folks, it isn't enough just to invest in our physical infrastructure. We also have to invest in our people, which we always did. We invested in our people. That's why the second bill is the so-called Build Back Better plan. And here's what it does. It takes education. As I said, when America made 12 years of public education standard a century ago, it gave us the best educated, best prepared workforce in the world. And you saw what happened. Think of what happened after World War I and how America moved. Because we were the best educated overall country in the world. And we led in the 20th century. But as I said earlier, we know that 12 years is not enough any longer to compete in the 21st century. Study after study shows that earlier our children begin to learn, the better for themselves, their families, and for the nation. You know, you all know the statistics, and some of your teachers and your husband used to talk to me about this, and it was really basic, that if you come from a home where the mom or dad have books on the shelves and on the coffee table and read, and you come from a home where mom or dad can't read or has a sixth grade education or has a little difficulty, the child coming from that middle-class home is going to have heard a million more words spoken, not different words, spoken, than the child coming from a middle-class home. And that's because, look, what do? You all know with your children and grandchildren. You start talking to them when they're in the cradle. You engage them. They're the people who sit at the dinner table and still talk. They're engaged. So many homes. Mothers or fathers don't have the capacity or inclination to do that. But right now, what are we doing? We're lagging behind. Today, only about half of the 3- and 4-year-olds in America are enrolled in early education at all. Germany, France, the UK, Latvia, their number is over 90% of the children. It's not just early education. According to one study, we rank 12th among advanced economies when it comes to the percentage of our young people who've attained any sort of post-high school degree. Ranked 12th in the world. The Build Back Better plan gets us back on track. We'll make 2 years of high-quality preschool available to every child in America. Every child. And we're going to make investments in education beyond high school. That includes increasing Pell Grants, which nearly 200,000 students in Pennsylvania from low-income families rely on to attend college. We're going to increase it by $500 so it becomes $1,900. The bill invests in our workforce, providing much-needed breathing room for families. My dad used, I remember when we moved to Wilmington. We finally were able, after 4 years, Dad could buy a house. And we lived in a development. It was a lovely area, in a suburban area. But it was a three-bedroom, split-level home. And we had four kids and my grandpa who lived with us, or another relative for all those years we lived there. And my bed was up in my headboard, my bed was up against the wall. That was when my dad and mom's bed was up against the wall. I look back, it was great for us having grandpops and relatives there. I don't know how my parents quite did it, but I remember one night, I'm serious, it was in high school. And Dad, I could feel my dad was restless. He moved and I could hear it in bed. And I asked the next morning, I asked my mom, it's a true story. I said, what's the matter with Dad, Mom? He said he got bad news, honey. His company just said they're no longer going to pay for health insurance. Well, guess what? My dad used to say everybody's entitled. All we're looking for is just a little breathing room. Just a little bit of extra room. A little breathing room. How can we compete in a world of millions of American parents, especially moms, can't join the workforce because they can't afford the cost of child care or elder care, or they have to stay home? I heard my colleague speaking before I did. Here in Pennsylvania, the average annual cost of child care for your toddler is $11,400. It's higher in other places. So the average two-parent family with two young kids spends 22% of their income for child care every year. I was a single dad for 5 years. I got elected to the Senate. I got a phone call before I got sworn in when I was hiring staff saying my wife and daughter had just been killed. And my two boys were seriously injured. They were hospitalized for a long time. So that's why I eventually started commuting. But I continued to commute because I could no more afford. And I was making a lot of money then. Now, granted, I was listed for 36 years as the poorest man in Congress, but I was making $42,000 a year. I didn't think my job was to make money when I was in Congress. But this is not a joke. I could no more afford child care than fly. But fortunately, I had a hell of a family. Those values I talked about. My sister and her husband, after a little bit, they gave up their home. I came home one night, and they moved into my home, helped me raise my kids. 5 years later, no man deserves one great love, let alone two. 5 years later, when I met and married Jill, I came home after the wedding, they'd moved out. My brother, Jimmy, my best friend, my mother, they all helped me take care of my kids. But I couldn't have done it. So I understand, how in God's name do people make it? If you look at the world of advanced economics and those with advanced economies, the countries invest an average of, each of those countries invest an average of $14,000 per year in child, state-sponsored child toddler care. America invests $500, 28 times less than our competitors. Here's what it does to our economy. You all know it. 30 years ago, we ranked seventh in the world among advanced economies in the share of women in the workforce. Today, in America, we rank 23rd. And women are becoming, not joke, better educated than men. If you look at, and I do about 5 college commencements a year, 4 of those 5, the valedictorian out of those classes for the last 10 years has been a woman. And if you read the data now, we're worried about the number of men attending college. Once again, our competitors are investing. We're standing still. My Build Back Better plan is designed to get us moving again. Look, it's going to cut the cost of child care for most Pennsylvania families in half. No middle-income family will pay more than 7% of their income on child care under my proposal. 7%. It's going to help more people get back to work in the workforce and make ends meet. It's also going to extend the historic middle-class tax cut for parents. Everybody talks about, and by the way, I'm going to say something self-serving, but I got on pretty well in the Senate for all those years. A lot of Republican friends as well as Democratic friends, for real. Kind of like Bobby. I mean, they're friends. We used to travel together a lot. And here's the deal, though. You know, what I was able to do when we passed the American Rescue Plan in the first month of my administration, which has allowed us to have all the funding for COVID. And when I started off, there were 2 million people in America that had gotten a vaccine. Well, guess what? We're up to 190 million. That's how we got it paid for. But here's the deal. What it meant was that, you know, right now there's a whole new attitude that's out there. How do we not invest? So in that act that we passed, we provided for a child tax credit. And you heard my introducer speak to it. Because we're in such dire straits, we were able to put in a position a tax cut for middle-class people. That's what it is. No one has a tax cut when we want to cut the capital gains tax for the wealthy or anybody. No one has a problem when we deal with that. We have over 55 corporations in America, the Fortune 500, don't pay a single solitary penny in taxes. Not one cent. Not one cent. They make $40 billion a year. But when you talk about a tax cut for middle-class people, and that's exactly what it is. By what we did, increasing and making a refundable tax cut, you know, the way it works now, if you made enough money to have owe more than $4,000 in taxes, and you had two kids, you got to deduct it. And here's the deal. The fact of the matter is that if you didn't make that kind of money, you didn't get the benefit at all. It wasn't refundable. You didn't get the benefit at all of the tax cut. Because if you didn't have more than $4,000 in taxes, you didn't, you know, you still paid. And it wasn't refundable. You didn't get it back. Well, here's the way we work it. We said, all right, for temporarily what we're going to do is make sure there's a child care tax credit. If you had one kid under seven, you get $3,600 a year. And if you have one over seven to 17, you get $3,000 a year. We upped it from $2,000. Well, guess what? It's cut child poverty in Pennsylvania by 55% and the nation by 50%. It's a flat-out tax cut for ordinary people. That's what it does. I make no apologies for it. But look, folks, there's so many things that we can do to change the way in which we work all of this. And I realize I'm going on here, but the fact is there's so much at stake. So much at stake. Look, the fact is that most of all what it does is, you know, we have a sandwich generation that exists. And many of you are part of that generation. You have a mom or dad needs some help when they get older. And you have a child that needs some help if you're going to be able to be in the workforce. And it's hard as hell. Hard as hell to make it work. You got to give these folks a little bit of breathing room. The single greatest champion for elder care in the United States of America is this guy right here, Bobby Casey. Not a joke. Not a joke. The way it works right now, if you qualify for Medicaid, you have to have a lower income to qualify for Medicaid, not Medicare, Medicaid. There are 820,000 seniors, people with disabilities who are on Medicaid on a waiting list to get home care, which they're entitled to. How many families are living this story? Your parents get older, they need some help getting around the house, making the meals for themselves, don't want to put them in nursing homes, not only because of the cost, but because of a matter of dignity. They do better, they live longer if they can stay in their own home. But you also don't have the time or the money to take care of them at home to do it. So you're just looking for an answer so your parents can keep living independently. And if they hold here a second, one of the things that is important, think about this. In order to get into that nursing home, you got to sell everything you have. You can't have any private property. You have to empty your bank account. You have to do it all to move in a nursing home. I'm not saying nursing homes aren't valuable. They are. They're extremely valuable. But that's not where I remember my uncle was moved in with his wife into a assisted living center, and he wanted, and the folks who had built the facility, it was a lovely facility in Delaware, asked if I'd come and speak on the opening of it. And we're walking out, and I said, Mom, isn't this beautiful? She looked at me and said, and she was then 76 years old, she said, this is for old people, Joey. Not for me. But think about it. For millions of families, this is the most important issue they're facing. It's personal. It's personal. And Bob Casey gets it. When Bobby fights for something, he never gives up, in case you haven't noticed. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to expand services for seniors so families can get help with well-trained, well-paid professionals to help them take care of their parents at home, to cook a meal for them, to get them their groceries when they need to get groceries, to help them get around, to just put in railings on their home. My mom lived with me. She moved in with me We finally talked her into doing it. And guess what? My sister takes her up. You remember this. Jeannie remembers this, talking about this, too. She takes her up to get her prescriptions, drives her back, gets out of the house, and she was it was this little home off of our home. It was, she wouldn't move into the, physically move into the house, even though we had done the whole thing over for her. And she's just standing there and moves and breaks her hip. She didn't trip or anything. Broke her hip. Well, guess what? Just having a railing, just having a place where she could walk from one room to the other, and help them in their own home with the dignity they deserve. Quite frankly, what we found is that this is more popular than anything else I'm proposing. When you do this individual polling data, this is extremely popular because we all feel that obligation to our parents, and we want them to live with dignity. Look, because American people understand the need. It's a matter of dignity. It's a matter of pride. Look, that's what both these initiatives are all about. And frankly, they're about more than giving working families a break. They're about positioning our country to compete in the long haul. Economists left, right, and center agree. Early this year, the Wall Street outfit Moody's projected that the investments I'm talking about will create, for the next 20 years, on average, 2 million additional jobs per year. Good-paying jobs. It's transformative. And we can make these transformation investments and be fiscally responsible. Take the infrastructure bill. All those investments, road, bridges, high-speed rail, internet, the whole deal, they represent less than 0.5% of our economic growth each year. Less than 0.5%. And the cost of the Build Back Better bill in terms of adding to the deficit is zero. 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 Because we're going to pay for it all. In addition to that, half of it is a tax cut. It's not spending money. It's a tax cut for working class people. It's about time, as I said, and I come from the corporate state of the world. Not a joke. More corporations are in registered in my state than every other state in the United States combined. And I represented the state of DuPont, as they used to call it, for 36 years. I'm not anti-business, but I'm about just begin pay your fair share. Look, folks, under this proposal and under this proposal, these proposals I'm talking about, I guarantee you that no one making under $400,000 a year will see one single penny in tax go up. Not one. In fact, the plan cuts taxes for working people. And by the way, if you notice the way you usually pay for infrastructure is by gasoline taxes, I wouldn't allow that because that would tax people making under $400,000. I'm a man of my word. Not one single penny will you pay if you make more than less than $400,000. So, but there's no reason why someone making $400 million a year. By the way, during this, all the crisis we've had with COVID, there's an absolute finite number of billionaires they can count up in the tax code. You know how much money the billionaires made last year collectively? They're not bad guys. I'm not saying that. They made $1 trillion increase their collective income. $1 trillion. Just pay a fair share. If you are a multimillionaire or billionaire, you have a lower tax rate than a family that has a teacher and a firefighter as a percent of taxes you pay. Lower. As I said, 55 of our largest corporations pay zero in income tax. $40 billion. This needs to change. Working folks understand that. That's why, despite the attacks of misinformation about my plans, are still overwhelmingly supported by the American people. They understand that when families have a little breathing room, America's in a better spot. And they know this is about dignity and respect, about building an economy from the bottom up and the middle out, not from the top down. As I said, name me a time in American history when the middle class has done well, the wealthy haven't done very well. Name me a time. So let me close with this. For too long, working people of this nation, the middle class in this country, the backbone of the country, have been dealt out. It's time to deal them back in. I ran for president. I ran for president saying it was time to rebuild the backbone of the nation. And by that, I was very precise. The middle class has been the backbone of this nation. I couldn't have been any clearer. That's why I wrote both these bills in the first place and took them to the people. I campaigned on them. The American people spoke. They have no doubt about what I ran on. Both these bills were all what I talked about. But guess what? 81 million people voted for me. More people voted than any time in American history. And their voices deserve to be heard, not to be denied, or worse, be ignored. Because here's what I know. If we make the investments, there's going to be no stopping America in the remainder of the 21st century. I've long said, and I mean this to every world leader I've known, and I've now spoken to over 60 of them. And I've known them, many of them before that. I tell them, it's never, ever, ever been a good bet to bet against America. No, never. Never, never. Which means it's always a good bet to bet on America. That's what these initiatives do. They bet on America. It's about believing in the American people. About believing. Just look at the history of the journey of this nation. What becomes clear is this. Given half a chance, the American people have never, ever, 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 ever let the country down. Just a fighting chance. No guarantees, just a chance. And that's what this is all about. And it does not increase the debt. When you talk about the number, we shouldn't even talk about the numbers because it's all paid for, written in the same piece of legislation. So you pass the spending, you're also passing the tax cuts, and you're passing the taxes that are going to be increased. Scranton, thanks for always treating me so nicely. I really mean it. God bless you all. And may God protect our troops. Thank you.
I want to get some analysis and some reporting. Our chief political correspondent, Dana Bash, is with us. Our senior White House correspondent, Phil Mattingly, is with us. Phil, the president seemed to be upbeat, potentially very optimistic that his two pieces of legislation will pass. He looked at the journalists who were standing there, said, you guys have been predicting failure. And then he said, but I think we're going to surprise them. What's the assessment right now?
You know, I think it was the second part, the sentence that immediately followed that, that stuck out most to me, which is he said, I believe people are beginning to realize what's at stake. And I think to some degree that maybe was the broader public. Obviously, this is the public push, something White House officials have been planning and hoping to get the president out more to do in the coming weeks. But also the behind-the-scenes push, where the president has been intensely focused over the course of the last several weeks to a degree where most people didn't know the details of those negotiations with two critical moderate senators until yesterday. They just started to leak out during Oval Office meetings with a series of House members. The what's at stake is a reflection of what we're hearing more and more from rank-and-file Democrats on Capitol Hill, a recognition that, yes, there are disagreements. Yes, this package will absolutely be scaled down in order to secure the requisite numbers of votes to get through the House and the Senate. But this is pretty much the be-all, end-all. This is the end game. This is what Democrats campaigned on. This is the really only opportunity Democrats have to pass these two significant pieces of legislation in total, more than nearly $4 trillion between the infrastructure plan and the climate and economic plan. And the recognition of those stakes, which the president has really focused on a lot over the course of the last several months, really seems to be settling in with those on Capitol Hill and is in large part driving some of the momentum we've very clearly seen come to the forefront over the course of the last couple days, Wolf.
It certainly is. And Dana, as you know, Scranton, Pennsylvania, very meaningful place for the president. He was born there. How effective was this speech as he tries to get this plan across the finish line in the next few days?
Well, this kind of speech, talking not about the numbers, not about the top lines, not about the intra-party fighting, but what exactly is in this extremely large package that they hope will finally come to fruition in the coming weeks. And, you know, a lot of Democrats I talk to admit that has been lost. The reality of the policies that the president campaigned on, that Democrats in Congress campaigned on have not been addressed in an aggressive enough way by all of them, from the White House over to Capitol Hill. And that is in part because for some of these policies, it has been unclear what's going to stay in and what's going to stay out. But what the president tried to focus on today were some of the fundamentals that he knows are absolutely going to be in, like the idea of putting money out there for the first time in an aggressive way to help people take care of people in their household who need it, whether it's their parent, whether it's their child, and they come out of the workforce to do that. Things like universal pre-K. So he obviously went to Scranton to try to connect himself, his middle class roots, his struggles that he's talked about for decades, to what he wants to do here. And again, it's something we're obviously going to hear him talk about in his town hall here on CNN tomorrow night. And he's starting to do it more aggressively as some of the specifics finally come together, as the differences begin to abate inside the party.
Yeah, we'll see how he does. It's a critical moment indeed. He's going to need all 50 senators to support this compromise, including Senator Sinema of Arizona, who has already said she opposes a lot of these tax increases on corporations and the wealthy. If she continues to hold that position, it's 49-51 with the Republicans. That would be the end. All right, we'll see what happens. They're really worried about Senator Sinema right now, even if Senator Manchin goes ahead and supports this compromise. Guys, I want you to stand by. And as you can see, President Joe Biden will be participating in a CNN town hall, an exclusive CNN town hall tomorrow night. Anderson Cooper will be the moderator. The president will be answering questions from the American public. It all begins tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern, only here on CNN. Meanwhile, there's other important news we're following. Tonight, the former Trump strategist Steve Bannon is a step closer to being held in contempt of Congress, with a full House vote of the resolution scheduled for tomorrow. CNN's senior legal affairs analyst Paula Reed has details.
Lawmakers investigating the deadly Capitol riot urged fellow representatives today to find Trump advisor Steve Bannon in contempt of Congress after he defied a subpoena.
We're not asking to talk to Steve Bannon on a whim. We believe he has firsthand specific knowledge that the Congress needs to have to conduct our investigation.
CNN has learned the GOP leaders are recommending a no vote on the referral, and Trump allies saying the investigation is an attempt to distract from Biden's failures.
Can't talk about inflation. Real wages gone down.
Give me a break. This is a political theater. I don't know what is.
But fellow Republican and committee vice chair Representative Liz Cheney reminded lawmakers why they need to talk to Trump allies.
They believed what Donald Trump said, that the election was stolen and that they needed to take action.
She specifically referenced comments Bannon made on January 5th.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen.
And he was right. Ask the over 140 Capitol Police officers who fought for hours and were injured. And there is no doubt that Steve Bannon knows far more than he says on that video.
Late Tuesday, the January 6th committee voted unanimously to advance criminal contempt proceedings to the House floor.
Aye.
Of the dozens of witnesses contacted by the committee so far, Bannon is the only one to completely refuse to cooperate.
Left unaddressed, this defiance may encourage others to follow Mr. Bannon down the same path.
Trump also seeking to block the committee, filing a late-night request Tuesday seeking an injunction to stop the National Archives from turning over some of his White House records.
They suggest that President Trump was personally involved in the planning and execution of January 6th.
A vote by the full House is scheduled Thursday. If it succeeds, the matter will be referred to the U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C. But the decision on whether to proceed with prosecution ultimately lies with Attorney General Merrick Garland, and it's not clear which way he will go. It's also not clear if these efforts to hold Bannon in contempt are having the intended deterrent effect. Today, a lawyer for Dan Scavino, another Trump associate who was subpoenaed, told CNN at this point his client is not ready to cooperate. Wolf.
All right, Paula, thank you very much. Paula Reed reporting for us. Let's discuss what's going on with one of two Republicans on the January 6th Select Committee, Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. Congressman, thanks as usual for joining us. So why is Bannon's testimony so important to your Select Committee that you're willing to go all the way to the U.S. Justice Department potentially with a criminal referral?
Well, I think all you have to do is look at the history of Steve Bannon with Donald Trump. No, he's been there from the beginning. You see, obviously, his comments the day before. And there's a lot of other information out there. But here's, I think the key is this. You know, you can't resist a subpoena from Congress. Congress has the same authority, in essence, as a court in that. And you can't resist a subpoena from court. But while we're going to continue to push, and we hope that the and expect the Justice Department will take up the contempt when we send it. The bottom line is there's a lot of people out there that know pieces of this, some of which have already willingly testified in front of us, given us information, some that will, and some that will not resist subpoenas to this level. It's very costly to do that, as it should be, because Congress, and this isn't the January 6th committee or even the Congress. Through Congress, it's the American people demanding transparency and accountability.
A lot of your Republican colleagues in the House are going to vote against this criminal referral. You know that.
Yeah, sadly, it's not surprising. You know, I hope it's not just two of us voting for it. I hope there's more. I think you can look back at a lot of statements from when the House, including me, voted to hold Eric Holder in contempt. It'll be interesting to compare some of the people's speeches from that day to today when we talk about contempt. And this is a direct assault on the U.S. democracy in the Capitol.
Your Republican colleague, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, even suggested that Bannon might have been, in her words, personally involved in planning the attack on the U.S. Capitol back on January 6th. Is there any evidence he was directly responsible?
I don't want to get into the evidence that we have or don't have. I'll keep that under wraps. Obviously, we're going to continue to find out what we can know, what we need to find out. But look, all you had to, you played the soundbite of Steve Bannon saying, look, tomorrow's going to be wild. It's not going to go down how you expect. Either he was clairvoyant or he knew something. You know, a lot of us predicted violence. I predicted violence on January 6th, a week or two prior, but I never expected that it would be to this level, that they would sack the Capitol. Steve Bannon seemed to know something, and we want to know what he knew.
Congresswoman Cheney also accused the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, of disrupting your investigation, the Select Committee's investigation. Do you agree?
Well, look, I mean, we had an opportunity to have a nonpartisan commission made up of former members, so you take the politics out of it. Then he had an opportunity to seat Republicans, and he polled them. So I certainly wouldn't say that's cooperating. And I think if they're whipping against, as I've heard they are, against this vote for contempt. Yes. I mean, look, the day after the insurrection, Kevin McCarthy said that Donald Trump holds the responsibility for this. 2 weeks later, he went down and resurrected his political life when he met with him in Mar-a-Lago. And since then, has been doing nothing but Donald Trump's bidding and bringing him back to political life. Look, people have to stand up and say this is wrong. You know, we've got to, if you think of the heroics on Flight 93 that saved the Capitol on 2001. It wasn't Todd Beamer alone. It was everybody standing up and saying, we've had enough. We're going to sacrifice ourselves to do this. And right now, we need more Republicans to stand up and lead your people. Lead your people. Tell them the truth. You know the truth. Tell them the truth.
Let's see if that happens. Is there any chance, Congressman, that this criminal referral will actually prompt Bannon to start cooperating with the Select Committee?
I think it's certainly the case, particularly if you see real movement in the Justice Department. So after tomorrow, it'll be out of our hands. I hope the Attorney General does the right thing. I hope the Justice Department does the right things. We have other tools in our toolkit, but our focus right now is on this and making it clear to others that will be subpoenaed. Don't resist Congress. You don't have a right to resist Congress because this is the by the people, of the people, for the people governance of this country.
Congressman Adam Kinzinger, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Anytime, Wolf.
Just ahead, I'll ask the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus about President Biden's plans to make major concessions to moderates as he tries to find a deal for his domestic agenda. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, there you see her. She's standing by. She's at Statuary Hall up on Capitol Hill. We'll discuss right after this. The breaking news this hour, President Biden speaking moments ago in his hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, trying to sell his sweeping agenda to working class voters as congressional Democrats appear closer and closer to reaching at least some compromise. Let's discuss with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining us. I know you've been talking extensively with President Biden. It now looks like he's ready to make some major concessions to try to get both of these pieces of legislation approved. But some of the concessions include no free community college, 2 years of community college apparently gone as far as no payment is concerned, parental leave cut in half, scale back climate measures. Do you think the Progressive Caucus is going to back these compromise proposals in order to get the deal?
Well, Wolf, thanks for having me. You're right. We have been in deep conversation with the president around the five priorities that the Progressive Caucus put out 5 months ago. And what I'm very happy to say is that all five of those are still on the table in a significant way. What we said to the president when we realized that even though we have 98% of Democrats in the House, the Senate, and the president with us on the Build Back Better Act that we had marked up in the House of Representatives, the reality is that's not enough. We need to get everybody on board. And so with the two senators, one of the things we had to do was cut back the price tag. The way that we wanted to do that, which the president agreed with and has included, is to just shorten the time frame for some of these investments. And so that is where we are. All of our priorities are included. And let me just say, Wolf, what that is. It means that we would provide childcare for every family in the United States so that no family pays more than 7% of their income in childcare. Pre-K across the country, universal pre-K, making sure that we're investing in care for our seniors with home and community-based care, making sure we're taking on the climate crisis. This is, of course, tricky. We're trying to figure out how we can cut carbon emissions. There isn't one single way to do that, so we're looking at the different ways that we could do that and still keep all 50 senators on board. And then, of course, investing in housing and taking on immigration and Medicare expansion. All of those things are on the table, Wolf, and I think it will mean a tremendous amount to every family across the United States when we pass this thing.
A hypothetical question, and it's a serious one, though, and I'm curious to get your thoughts. So say Democrats don't have the 50 votes they need in the Senate to pass it. The vice president, president of the Senate, cast a breaking tie. If Senator Kyrsten Sinema, for example, doesn't back the bigger spending bill, even $2 trillion or $1.7 trillion, but does support the $1.2 infrastructure package, do you think you and other progressives would vote for the infrastructure package and leave with that as opposed to getting nothing?
Well, if we're going to get both bills across the finish line, I am
really
confident.
What if Senator Sinema votes no?
That's not where we are.
Do you think she's going to vote yes?
Yes, I believe she is actually at the table negotiating with the president. I believe she's negotiating in good faith. I believe we're going to do both bills. And I don't think it's going to happen that we're going to lose one of the... That's why we're working so hard to try to get this all done. And I can assure people that the president has been terrific on this. I met with him for an hour and a half, just the two of us on Monday morning. I met with him again yesterday with a group of progressives. I know he's doing the same with others. I know he's working very hard with Senators Sinema and Manchin. And we are going to get this done because it is really important. And let me just say that this is a good thing that's happening right now. We are all talking to each other. I talked to Senator Manchin again today. I met with him the other day for a couple of hours. This is all good. This is what should be happening. And I'm really proud of the Progressive Caucus for keeping all of this together and keeping us in the fight to really leave nobody behind. And we're going to get it done. I really believe that, Wolf.
The President of the United States just said basically the same thing. He said, I think we're going to surprise them. We'll see what happens. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, as usual, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Wolf.
Coming up, new details on a stunning announcement from the FBI. Apparent human remains have been discovered during the search for Brian Laundrie. We're following breaking news in the manhunt for Brian Laundrie. I want to bring in CNN's Randy Kaye along with CNN legal analyst Paul Callan. Randy, tell us more about what the investigators found and what they said today.
Authorities were out here early this morning and they found what appeared to be human remains, according to the FBI, as well as a backpack and a notebook they believe belongs to Brian Laundrie, Gabby Petito's fiance. This was found in an area that had previously been underwater. This is a swamp of 25,000 acres. They'd been using swamp buggies and divers to search. Now the water has receded, so they were able to search areas that they hadn't been able to get to before. They've been out here searching since September 17th. The FBI now has evidence response teams here on the ground looking at the evidence, processing the scene. The FBI was out here earlier and spoke with reporters, and here's what they had to say about what they found.
Earlier today, investigators found what appears to be human remains, along with personal items such as a backpack and notebook belonging to Brian Laundrie. These items were found in an area that up until recently had been underwater. Our evidence response team is on scene using all available forensic resources to process the area.
And we understand from the Laundrie family attorney, Wolf, that Brian Laundrie's parents were here at the reserve when these human remains or what appear to be human remains were discovered. In fact, they were the ones who called the FBI and Northport police last night to say that they wanted to come here and search for their son. This area of the reserve and this park leading into the reserve had been closed previously. It just opened to the public yesterday. So they were out here this morning along with law enforcement and made that discovery, Wolf.
Yeah. Randy, stand by. Paul, the FBI, as you heard, it says it did recover some personal items belonging to Laundrie, including this backpack and a notebook. Could these items provide investigators with potentially some long-awaited answers?
Well, I think circumstantially the proximity of these personal items to the human remains make it highly likely that this is Brian Laundrie. I think DNA testing in the next few days will confirm that definitively. And if it turns out it's a suicide, it's the final cruel act of Brian Laundrie because he'll never be publicly held accountable and we'll never know what really happened. Only time will tell after a coroner has a look at those remains.
Paul Callan, thank you very much. Randy Kaye, thanks to you as well. Coming up, I'll speak with NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about Kyrie Irving's refusal to get vaccinated. Stand by. There's breaking news in the battle against COVID-19. The FDA has just authorized booster doses of the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines. The agency also gave the green light for boosters to be from a different brand than your original vaccine. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's vaccine advisors, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, meets Thursday, tomorrow, to decide on whether to recommend the FDA's authorization to the American people. And then the CDC director will decide whether to sign off. Meanwhile, we're also following another COVID controversy rocking the NBA. Charles Barkley slamming Nets star Kyrie Irving for refusing to get vaccinated. Joining us now to talk about the controversy, the NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He's written about it at kareem.substack.com. Kareem, thanks so much for all you're doing. Thanks for what you're writing. I want you and our viewers to listen to exactly what Charles Barkley had to say. Listen to this.
You don't get vaccinated just for yourself. Like Adam said, you get vaccinated for your family first. You get vaccinated for your teammates second. I really am proud of the Nets for putting their foot down, for saying, no, we're not going to deal with this half on, half off. The only thing that bugged me, he's still going to make $17 million sitting at home.
What do you think, Kareem? You agree with Charles Barkley? Does it bother you that Kyrie Irving is collecting the significant paycheck while leaving his team to play without him?
Well, Wolf, the financial aspect of it is not as important to me as the health aspect of it. People are getting sick and dying from this and having to spend a long time in the hospital near death. This isn't a joke. And being on the fence about it, going back and forth, is not helping. if he's making $17 million while he's doing this, God bless him, but getting our community protected is the key issue here. And that's what I want to focus on.
And I just want to be precise, that $17 million that he's going to make is for the away games. Even though he might not play with the team on the away games, he's not going to get paid for the home games in New York, in Brooklyn, because he refuses to get vaccinated. I want to read something you wrote about vaccinated players who seem to support the idea that getting the shot is simply a personal choice. You wrote this on Substack.com, and let me read it to our viewers. This tepid kid glove handling from players who have all gotten the vaccine appears more an attempt to preserve a congenial working relationship than true support for making asinine choices. Can you, Kareem, elaborate on that for us?
Well, you know, it seems to me that the public image of the league and the public image of the individual players involved is a lot more important than public safety. And that's absurd. I mean, we've got to, it doesn't matter who you are. You are at the same risk as everyone else, and you should be treated and expected to comply with safety measures that protect all of us.
How much responsibility, Kareem, do Kyrie Irving and other professional athletes, for that matter, have as a result of their huge platform?
Well, I think people who are followed, who have a huge platform like that, have a responsibility greater than just the average citizen. Young kids, especially, look up to Kyrie and are trying to model their lives after his and become great athletes. And his stance on this is, you know, it's backwards. And he has to understand that. He has to be a good teammate. What he's doing is making him a bad teammate. It is making him someone who doesn't care about the other guys. If you bring the COVID virus into an environment where people get sick, some people could get sick and die. So, you know, we have to recognize that and act accordingly, like we have some sense.
Well said, indeed. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, as usual, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for all you're doing.
No problem, Wolf. Nice talking to you.
And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. You can always follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Wolf Blitzer. Tweet the show at CNN Sit Room. And the Situation Room is also available as a podcast. Look for us on CNN.com/audio or wherever you get your podcasts. Aaron Burnett Out Front starts right now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max. A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.